Welcome to the fifth episode of our podcast Empower for Climate with Shanine O'Keefe and Stefan Xenger. Today we have an important topic on the occasion of one of the really important researchers on climate change, on boundaries, planetary boundaries, passed away recently, and we will speak about his legacy. Shanine, great pleasure to be here today again with you. I'd like to hand over to you.
Thank you, Stefan. I would like to acknowledge the country we are on, which is the never ceded Australia. So it is the land, the country I'm currently in is Nilau, which is Phillip Island in Victoria. And the Aboriginal people have never ceded this land. And we would like to acknowledge elders past and present. With that, I'd also like to extend a welcome to David Spratt, who's actually been in close contact over many years with climate and our meeting today is really to discuss the work of Will Stefan, a person who is well respected around the world for his climate work. So thank you, David Spratt, for joining us today. Would you like to please introduce yourself, your background in climate and where you are today?
Thank you. That's my pleasure. I'm just outside of Melbourne in Australia. I guess, do many things, but could probably be called a science communicator. I'm research director for the Breakthrough Centre for Climate Restoration in Melbourne. And I guess there are two things which probably explain my work and what I'm on about. The first is a book I wrote more than a decade ago with Philip Sutton called Climate Code Red, The Case for Emergency Action, which I think globally first codified the idea of climate as an emergency and basically said three things. This was in 2008. The first was that the science was worse than was being publicly understood and communicated. The second was that 2 degrees was far too high a goal, because 2 degrees was all the rage in climate policy making circles at the time. And the third was that the task was now so urgent that it actually needed, in Will Stefan's words, for climate to become the first priority of politics and economics. That is, we need to think of it the way we respond to emergencies or to war mobilizations and make this the first focus of society. So that's where I started from with that book. And I guess more recently, I spent a lot of time understanding the science, communicating it, understanding that the work of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is actually very conservative. And so I wrote a report with Ian Dunlop called What Lies Beneath the Underestimation of Existential Climate Risk in 1917, which I think really helped to open up the whole debate about risk and the scientific method, the understatement of the risks, and why, in our words, climate was an existential risk. And of course, I think that language has also become the work of many people, not just us, has become a predominant theme now. So that's where I came from, and that's why Will Stefan's work is so important, because he was really in this space of understanding the climate as part of the Earth system, a really big picture approach.
So you've already now mentioned that Will Stefan obviously had an impact on your work. He's obviously done a lot to create the scientific terminology to kind of even better understand what is on stake and what's going on this planet. Now, let's maybe clarify a little bit this terminology, because I think it's really important to have a better understanding of it. Many people are speaking about tipping points, etc., but I think not many really do fully understand what that precisely means. And before we then speak about really what we need to do, could you explain some of these terms? I mean, I think hothouse Earth, planetary boundaries is also something I find very important. Mm-hmm. And tipping points, let's say cascading tipping points. Could you kind of
elaborate? There's a whole lot of there's a whole lot of interrelated ideas there. And I think it goes back to the fact that Will Steffen, who was an American but spent, you know, the last 50 years of his life in Australia, was part of a core group of people that included people like Johan Rockström and Tim Lenton and John Schellenhuber, who really tried to understand the climate as an integrated system, as a complex relationship of a whole lot of processes. And this, of course, goes back to the work initially of a maverick scientist called James Lovelock, who with Lynn Margulis in the late 1970s proposed the idea of Gaia, which everybody thought was a bit crazy at the time when he said that, they said that that the Earth is a whole active system that is actually self-regulating. And over time, while it was first, because, you know, Lovelock was a brilliant man, but not within the scientific establishment, that idea, people thought it was a bit crazy. But gradually scientists started to come to work and think about that. And Will Steffen was absolutely key in developing what then, which was acknowledging that Lovelock was right, and developing what we now call Earth system science. So the Earth is a system and the climate is part of that system. So the interaction between the ecosystems, the geology, the physics, the chemistry of the Earth, and how it works together to sustain itself and to stabilize itself. And as soon as you get into that theory, then you're talking about a complex system, and a complex system basically has a number of well-defined states and the transitions between them. And one of the things that the scientists, climate scientists pointed out, is that over the last million years or more, even though we've had ice ages, the Earth has moved between two stable systems, one at 280 parts per million, which is what we're in a warm period, and a cold period. And it just flips between these two discrete states. And this is important to understand, that any complex system can only exist at certain states. And as soon as you understand that, you can have points of system stability, which is what we had for the last 10,000 years of human settlement, the Holocene of stable conditions. And now our human actions with fossil fuels in interrupting that system are now causing disruptions in the system. And from that, we get to all those things that you wanted to talk about, Stefan. So I guess the first one is the idea that a system is stable, and then there can be a point at which it destabilizes and moves to a different state. And in a chapter that Will Steffen wrote for a book last year, he used the idea of a canoe. You can be in a canoe, you can rock it a bit, and you can stay in the water. You know, it uprights itself. But if the canoe tips so far, suddenly you're underwater and the canoe has moved to a different state. So this is the idea. I mean, it's a bit like the ice block. If the ice block is in the freezer, it's frozen. As soon as you take the ice block out and put it on the table, you have created the conditions for a system change. That is, as soon as it comes out of the freezer, it's past its tipping point, because sitting on the table, it is going to melt. So the idea is that in any system, there's a tipping point or a threshold in which a small change will initiate a much larger change and take the system to a different state. The other, I think, really big associated idea is what's called a positive feedback, where a process of initial change in the system will drive further change. So it becomes self-reproducing. And this, of course, I mean, there are many examples in the climate system. Perhaps the best is in the Arctic, where we have a large sheet of sea ice, a very thin ice floating on the Arctic Ocean. And with climate warming, warmer oceans start to melt the ice. As the ice melts, reflective ice is replaced by dark ocean, which absorbs more heat. And that dark ocean then produces more ice loss. So it becomes a self-reproducing. This is a positive feedback. So I think they're the two big things that within systems there are processes that will keep the system changing through these feedbacks, and that you can reach a point or a threshold or a tipping point where the system will inevitably move to a different state. So, for example, we have scientists now saying that there are glaciers in West Antarctica that have passed their tipping points. They're still there, but the existing climate systems are enough for them to melt. And I guess the third big one, and this really kind of all comes back to work that Will and his colleagues were doing, is that these system changes can cascade, interlink, and run through each other. And you know, there's a really classic example that we see in climate change. If we come back to the Arctic, where the sea ice is melting, the Arctic is becoming warmer. As the Arctic becomes warmer, that's puts pressure on the Greenland ice sheet. And the Greenland ice sheet starts to melt. The melting of the Greenland ice sheet is pouring more cold water into the top of the Atlantic Ocean. That is slowing the AMOC, the Atlantic Meridian Overturning Circulation, often called the Gulf Stream. Greenland is slowing the Gulf Stream, the AMOC, and the slowing of AMOC is changing precipitation over the Amazon and drying out the Amazon and producing carbon release from the Amazon, so that now scientists say that eastern Amazonia is a net source of carbon. So that's a really classic example of a system cascade from the sea ice to Greenland to the Gulf Stream to the Amazon. So those are sort of tools within which people like Will Steffen have thought about the climate system. And then, of course, they came to the question of planetary boundaries, the boundaries of the systems.
If I may ask, I mean, you have these are obviously very complex interdependencies, relations that must have taken years, decades to find the empirical evidence. But how is this done? How do you find the evidence for that? What you say is now not just a model, but that is what is actually happening.
Well, I mean, there's a paper just come out that shows that what happens in the Amazon in terms of temperature is having an effect on the Tibetan Plateau. And this was just published earlier this year. And they did that by using really large-scale data analysis and just found this statistical relationship. So they know what they look for. So I think modern tools can see more of this. But obviously, there's a lot of hard slog to put these relationships together. But it is also the laws of physics and chemistry. We know that when the ice arcs, the idea that a dark material absorbs more heat than when ice is replaced by dark sea, the system will warm, is well known in physics. The idea that Greenland, which is sitting in the middle of the Arctic, is going to melt if there's more heat in the Arctic is straightforward. So I think you know, the theoretical ideas are there, and then you just need the really painstaking work to work out where, if and where and when those tipping points will happen. And I mean, whether that's Antarctica or Amazon, establishing a tipping point is, you know, requires a huge amount of on-the-ground work.
Okay, that actually brings me to another point, that the climate models used by the IPCC, so the Intergovernmental Panel, to put these models together, are they actually including these tipping points, and in particular the cascading tipping points?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is a great question. This is, you know, the heart and soul of what I've been writing about. And I mean, Will Steffen last year was co-author of a really important paper called Climate Endgame: Exploring Catastrophic Climate Change Scenarios. Just people find it, just look up Climate Endgame. I think it's really important because he goes to the heart of this question, and I'll have to digress a little. In the climate change, there are things which are linear and easy to understand. We know when we add greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, the system will warm. That's a fairly straightforward relationship. We know that for every 1 degree of warming of the atmosphere will hold approximately 7% more water vapor. So as you get warmer, you can get heavier rain events. These are linear relationships. But then, because of the nature of systems, where they exist in discrete states and then can, in an abrupt way, move to one state to the other, there are also parts of the climate system which are not linear. I remember when we were running Climate Code Red, there was this non-linear event in the summer of 2007 in the Arctic, where the amount of sea ice really dropped dramatically. And a very great cryosphere scientist called Richard Alley said, it's melting 100 years ahead of schedule, which really goes to this fact that there was a non-linear event that just wasn't anticipated. And those non-linear events cannot be adequately put into models, because a model is about statistical relationships between events. And if something is non-linear, you can't put a probability on it happening. And so in this recent paper on climate endgame, Will Steffen and his colleague says, climate damages are likely to be non-linear. And because of that, it's really important that when we look at future climate change scenarios, we look at the bad to worst case scenarios. And this is something that his colleague John Schellenhuber said as well, and it's why the science is objectively reticent. Schellenhuber points out, particularly with models and the economic energy climate models, called integrated assessment models, which are shocking in this regard, they're about statistical relationships and they're about probabilities. You know, there's a 50% probability of 2 degrees or not 2 degrees. And Schellenhuber said, when the future of human civilization is at stake, it's not the probabilities that matter, it's the possibilities. And this is what we have written on a lot. He said, you know, and this is the question in existential risk management. Mm-hmm. It's not the 50% chance is happening. The really important question is, what is the worst thing that could feasibly happen and how can you stop it? This is what we do with nuclear weapons. We say, what's the worst thing that can feasibly happen and how do we stop it? So it's not about probabilities. It's about the high-end possibilities. And Will Steffen and his colleagues said, we've got to look at the worst-case scenarios. There are large uncertainties about dangerous surprises in the system, but that's the reason to prioritize them rather than neglect them. And I think that's a really important lesson, that we've got to look at these nonlinear events which are not well incorporated into the models, understand the possibilities and work out how to stop them happening. And that was at the key of the work that Rockström and Schellenhuber and Will Steffen and so on have been doing.
I mean, I think what you describe is how we usually behave in a normal life. I mean, we all have insurances.
Of course.
Got an insurance, renewed for our office, and then minimize, and it's not for linear kind of expectations that I expect there will be this and this much. And insurance is also telling me what to do to protect the office against burglar, for example. But we don't behave that in climate.
This is the scandal of partly, largely of international climate policy making. I mean, I say to people when I speak, you know, would you jump on a plane if there's a 1 in 2 chance of it crashing? And they go, no. I said, a 1 in 10 chance. 10% chance of, they say no. I say 100, 1% chance. They say no. And I say, but you're out and you're advocating for a carbon budget, which has a 50% chance, a 1 in 2 chance of exceeding the dangerous level. And I said, and because of those high-end possibilities, I mean, a carbon budget that has a 50% chance of keeping to 2 degrees has got a 10% chance of getting to 4 degrees. So you're exactly right. I mean, in modern engineering, we have, you know, built-in failure rates of 1 in 1 million or 1 in 10 million for planes and bridges and lifts and everything we live in and the cars we drive or bikes or whatever. But when it comes to the climate system, we've used a completely different risk management system, which is suicidal.
Absolutely. And the classic thing, you know, we always hope for the best, but plan for the worst.
Yes,
and we're not
yes.
going, we're not doing the planning for the worst case.
No,
that's
and
really
this is
what you're fundamentally saying.
And this is the point that Will and others are making, that looking at the climate system, understand its complexity, understand the relationship between these various systems, these various parts of the system, understand how they can trigger each other. as we talked about in the Arctic and Greenland and so on, and understand that there are boundaries. And this was, you know, really some of the most important work that Will Steffen did with Johan Rockström and others in a really famous paper in 2009 called A Safe Operating Space for Humanity, in which they looked at the Earth system as a whole and said, if we take the planet before humans started burning fossil fuels, this period of the Holocene of stability, as a reference point, let's understand the various parts of the Earth system that if we perturb them too much, could take us out of the Holocene into a different period. And Will, of course, was important in identifying with Paul Crews and this idea of the Anthropocene, which we can talk about in a moment. But then they said, if we look at the Earth system and these boundaries, then they identified a whole lot of things which are really crucial, which is obviously the amount of carbon dioxide in the air, how hot it is, the amount of carbon dioxide in the oceans in terms of the acidity of the oceans, stratospheric ozone, which we'd seen the consequences of perturbation of that system, obviously the integrity of ecosystems, the flows of nitrogen and phosphorus into the system, fresh water use, land use, and so on. So they had these nine boundaries, and they said for carbon dioxide, for climate warming, that the boundary was under 350 parts per million. We'd start off pre-industrial with 280. They said 350, as Jim Hansen had, the great NASA climate chief, when policymakers were talking about 450 parts per million at Copenhagen in 2009, exactly the same year, Rockström and Steffen come out and say, no, not 450, 350, not 2 degrees, 1 degree. And in fact, in a book chapter that came out last year, Will said, given what we've seen, and he was writing after we had those terrible black summer fires, he says, given what we've seen around the world, and we've seen it this year with incredible events, he says, climate change is already dangerous at 1 degree. And I think that's another really important understanding. So I think the planetary boundaries work really changed the discussion about what's sustainable.
Yeah, I think it's really important to also use these terms. And I think people speak about tipping points. People speak about planetary boundaries, maybe to a lesser degree. Mm. But let's come. It's very interesting also for me to learn about how you explain or try to explain the complexity of the system with just a few sentences, because time is always limited.
Think of the canoe. It's stable up to a certain point, and then it's not.
that's an excellent image. Indeed.
That's the tipping point when you're no longer in the canoe.
Do you think that when we talk about the public perception, the public debate, there's always also this, now we talk not about scientific, but the wrong balance in the public debate that 99% of scientists say this, but for a TV show, they invite one who has another opinion, and so that it looks like it's not 99 yeah. to 1, but it's 50 to 50. And isn't that in particular the case with social media? How you must be quite desperate with all the scientific work you've been involved to, you've dealt with, and then following the public discussion.
We can't help right-wing media nut jobs who want to create a false balance. That's beyond my power. And Janine and I live in Australia where Rupert Murdoch rules. So that's a particular problem. You're much more enlightened in Europe. You don't have quite the same problem. I mean, obviously that's challenging, but in order to make proper climate policy, you have to understand the system as it really exists. And what worries me is not just the fossil fuel companies and conservative media, but amongst policymakers and the people I deal with in government and in high-level business, they don't get it either. They're still talking about 1.5 to 2 degrees. They're talking about 1.5 degrees when we've already passed the physical conditions for 1.5. At the moment we're heading towards 3 degrees because they're not doing anything, and they're talking about, oh, our 1.5 to 2 degree goal. And I have to say, there are many reasons for it, there is there there is a lot of willful ignorance at a government level and a global corporate level, where they simply do not want to or are not capable of dealing with the evidence which is clearly before them for, I think, one really simple reason, and it is this. As we argued in Climate Code Red, the circumstances back then were so urgent that we actually needed a global mobilization of resources. We talked about the war economy, but you can talk about the moonshot or, you know, all sorts of other things to make this the first priority, and that acting on climate change was going to be disruptive. Not acting on climate change was going to be more disruptive because none of us were going to be here, which is essentially the path, you know, we're heading towards now, but that it would necessarily be disruptive of the free market system because states would have to lead. States have to lead when you're in an emergency situation, and the political and business elite cannot get their heads around the fact that the political economy paradigm, which they have ruled over for centuries, but particularly, you know, the more recent period of neoliberalism, is incompatible with dealing with the problem. And this is I've just written a paper this which will be published in Europe in a couple of months, but that's the key problem, that it is politically and economically inconsistent with the prevailing norms.
So do we understand that the media itself, it's not just social media, it's the general media. We have obviously talked about Murdoch, but even the general media, and even in Sweden, where there's I think 300 different owners of different media sources, they're still also struggling with this. They're not seeing through the politicians on this issue either. They're just playing along as if,
well,
there wasn't an emergency.
Well, I mean, I think if you look at systems in a social science or political sort of way, I mean, sort of following, I don't know, whoever you want to, Gramsci or, you know, the post-war European theorists, all systems have an ideology or a structure of ideas that keep them going. And if you look at what we could call the international policy-making system, I mean, which is business and lobbyists and these meetings of the IPCC and the meetings of the UNFCCC, this whole process of making climate policy, that is a system that has a particular ideology or a set of dominant ideas around it, which is reproduced all the time. And it is that 1.5 to 2 degrees is a good target, that we've got a carbon budget left for that when we don't have any carbon budget, that we've got plenty of time, that we've got to 50 years, we've got another 30 years, we can get it to 2050 and solve the problem. And at 2050, we'll have this thing called net zero. And when you look at the international, for example, the Network for Greening the Financial System, which is the world's central banks, their scenario for net zero 2050 has around 40% of energy still coming from fossil fuels in 1950, because the net zero is because we're going to have all these magical things called carbon capture and storage, which are going to solve the problem and net out the problem. So, I mean, the set of ideas that I've just described, I think, are the predominant paradigm in international climate policy making, and it is clearly designed to obliterate the problem, to pretend that we're doing okay when we're not, that we've got time when we're not. And I think that's, you know, that's the problem. There is an ideological system around climate policy making which ensures its failure.
That's a very interesting thought. You spoke about also like the role of carbon budgets and how that is kind of, if I may use the word misused, to kind of create this illusion as if we still have a lot of time not to do anything. Coming from a renewable energy perspective personally, and kind of trying really to change in that sector, the kind of the paradigm, I've always looked very critically to these ideas of carbon budget and trading, etc. So, but how, I'd like to ask you, how do you think is this related to the important idea and the important concept of planetary boundaries, because it seems to refer to that, but in fact, obviously is maybe exceeding those boundaries, or how would you relate those
look,
two things?
I don't think, I mean, if you accept that, even in terms of putting climate to one side, that we as a global society, and the rich white folks in particular, are consuming 1.7 planets worth of resources every year. I mean, even with that climate, our resource use is clearly unsustainable. But that doesn't enter into the climate discussion as well. I mean, we face a climate and a sustainability emergency. And I mean, this is willful ignorance. I mean, Will Steffen published a paper 3 or 4 years ago, which was known colloquially as the Hothouse Earth paper. I think it technically was in 2018, and technically it was called Trajectories of the Earth System in the Anthropocene, but it became known as the Hothouse Earth paper. It was the most downloaded paper in scientific publishing history. It was downloaded 270,000 times in the first week after publication. So, I mean, when you talk about media, it really caught media imagination and went around the world, and all sorts of people who had never read a scientific paper before, you know, read it and downloaded it. And they said that because of what we're talking about before, the tipping points and the feedbacks and the cascades, that the climate system can get to a point of no return where it will just keep on warming. So even if we humans stop emitting greenhouse gases, the perturbations are already underway, you know, the loss of carbon from permafrost, from forests, from the Amazon and so on, could just keep on driving heating up further to a point where the Earth became a hothouse, a bit like, you know, Mars, and humans simply couldn't live there. And this is just the logic of systems theory, of a system so perturbed that it just goes to a completely different state. And they said in that paper, and everybody said, oh yeah, hothouse Earth, like it was, you know, a cool term. And they said in that paper, the threshold of a hothouse Earth could be between 1.5 and 2 degrees. And I think John Schellenhuber said it could even be under 1.5. Now, we're going to be at 1.5 within 10 years, and our climate history tells us that the current level of greenhouse gases, 120 parts per million, in the end, is probably enough for 3.5 degrees of warming. So we, you know, and this is discussion that never makes it onto policymaking table at all.
So I think it was a really good term that you used, which is willful ignorance.
Yeah.
Actually, in the chat, somebody's actually, Janus has said it's about irresponsibility more than ignorance, which matches willful ignorance. The second comment is maybe this is, if you know you're going to hit an iceberg, or if you know your canoe is going to turn over, it's better not to spread panic. And this is
Is this the hope versus fear business?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Please.
Yeah. Yes. Interesting question. I've worked with a lot of climate NGOs who always say, hope, 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 you've got to inspire people, you know, feel better, hope, hope, hope. But hope is not a strategy. I mean, we are genetically hardwired for fear, the flight or fight response, because fear actually keeps us alive. So hope versus fear is the wrong formulation. In fact, if you look at health promotion anywhere in the world, I mean, whether it's AIDS or smoking or whatever, there's always a really good health promotion process always has three steps in it. The first step says, if you do this, you're going to die. If you keep on smoking, you're going to die. That's the fear. Then it says, but there's hope because you can stop and your lungs will repair rapidly. So you've got fear and you've got hope. And then they say, and the third element is an efficacious path, that is how to get from fear to hope. And they say, okay, I know you're smoking, but you can ring our quit line and we can help you to stop smoking. And by the way, the statistics show that every time you try and stop, you're actually closer to stopping. So it's from hope to fear with a viable path. And I mean, I think that the same is true of climate change. I mean, when you look at risk and risk management, you cannot honestly assess the risks. If you can't assess risk properly if you're not honest about them. Yep. And so when people say to me, hope or fear, I say, neither, just courage.
I like this also explaining it with how it is with smoking. I mean, the earlier you stop, the better it is. That is, I think everybody understands that nowadays.
But you know, I mean, we saw it with, I mean, even with COVID, even though COVID probably went off the line, they said, this thing is really bad. It's going to kill a lot of people. As soon as we have a vaccine, you have a vaccine, get the vaccine, fear you're going to die from COVID's going to really cause damage. B, the vaccine can make it tolerable, and most people get vaccinated, they get sick, but they don't die. And most people are still dying of COVID are people who are unvaccinated. And we're going to make the vaccine freely available to you. So, I mean, that was another classic sort of, public health promotion strategy with the same structure.
I think it's important to go from fear to hope with a strategy. And once again, Stefan, it's also the more often you try to stop, the better you get. So even with reducing coal, gas and oil, the more often you try to stop, the better you get at it.
And I think we can say the same thing here. I mean, what governments and leaders need to do is to say, hey, folks, yes, Will Stefan and companies were right. We are heading towards hothouse Earth. I mean, John Schellenhuber, who was the director of the Potsdam Institute for 20 years, I mean, an advisor to Angela Merkel and Pope Francis, I mean, perhaps the politically most influential eminent climate scientist in Europe, gave an interview last year, and he said, there's a bus full of kids heading off the cliff, and there's a 98% chance that it's going to crash. I mean, that's pretty, I mean, he's saying we're heading towards civilizational end, and I think that has to be said. And then you say, and what do we need to do to prevent that? And we say, there are lessons in our history. We have turned around terrible events. I mean, that's what we wrote Climate Code, read about emergency mobilization. I mean, we have seen it in emergency responses in Australia to fires. You've seen it in Europe with you know, responses to record-breaking floods and in Pakistan and so on. If the society throws everything at a problem, like we do in emergencies, we can solve it. So I think the climate problem has got the same thing, but let's not pretend that acting normal is going to solve the problem, because it's not.
Well, I mean, we've seen already that obviously on the kind of international level, even there is maybe, we just speak about even those UN climate change conferences, but IPCC, and then Antonio Guterres speaks very clearly about
it. He does. He's
very
been
clearly
wonderful.
Warning. But obviously that's not enough. So we are usually complaining about those UN agencies. Actually, they're clearer than what is happening on the ground. But now how do we address it? I mean, you're living in a country which I find very interesting to observe, because you have a strong, obviously, fossil lobby. And at the same time, it's amazing for me that suddenly Australia has become the world leader per capita in solar rooftop. So well, obviously look, there is some conflicting trends here. How can we strengthen the one part and kind of weaken the other part? How do we do that?
Well, I mean, I think in terms of Australia, I mean, Australia is just about the most well-endowed country in the world for both wind and solar capacity. I mean, the Sahara might be better endowed for solar, but I mean, we have a huge advantage in that we've got this hot, dry, sunny continent with huge amounts of solar capacity. And the southern part of the continent sits on the above the Antarctic Ocean and the Roaring Forties, and has got huge wind potential. And I mean, the reason why we've got such an uptake, and we have a state in Australia, South Australia, which now in some weeks is generating 100% of its power from renewables. And that is simply the market at work. I mean, business knows that there's money to be made in Australia because it's cheaper than coal, because we have gone down that cost curve. I mean, solar panels are less than 1% of the cost they were 30 years ago per watt of output. So it's the laws of business taking over. Unfortunately, they don't work quick enough.
Well, I mean, allow me to say here, I know why the prices went down, because I've been working with one of the politicians very closely, Hermann Scheer, who made the law that started the mass production. So it was a kind of,
Government intervention. It was government intervention and feed-in tariffs and supporting the technological take-up that drove this change. Absolutely. And that, I mean, it's another classic example of where government leadership was the key to the change in climate action.
What Germany did for solar, Denmark did for wind. They've been two different countries.
Yeah, yeah. But once again, it requires leadership to trigger these changes.
Yeah,
and the trigger we need now is a fearful dose of honesty about the risks and understanding not that we have the technologies available or not, because we do, but that it's going to be inconvenient, particularly for the rich Western elite. Somebody put some figures together and said, if you take the richest 10% of people in the world and reduce their emissions to the EU average emissions, you've got to rid of one third of global emissions, because that elite, the top 10%, and that's probably, you know, us, we're in the 10%, our emissions on average are so high that even if ours were cut to the EU average, one third of global emissions would disappear. So there's an equity issue in there that no Western country wants to talk about.
So tell us, David, what's your vision for the future?
Well, I'm 72 years old. I don't know how many more years I've got, so I don't think too far ahead. I mean, I think we are now absolutely heading for a crunch point. And I think that the climate policy making paradigm is that we've talked about is rapidly going to break down, because the talk about 1.5 and 2 degrees is no longer going to wash. And either there will be a huge political disruption, and I really admire people who are doing civil disobedience and really trying to change the story, because it's absolutely necessary. Either there will be a political disruption of enormous size, which will also mean a splitting of the elite, that there will be some parts of the corporate world who will actually decide that they want their grandchildren to live and will swap over to a different mode of behaviour. And if there isn't that disruption, then we are heading towards a global climate crisis such that, at the moment we're heading towards 3 degrees of warming in the system, perhaps more. And, you know, there is good analysis, including by, you know, intelligence analysts in the US, saying that at 3 degrees, you're going to have 1 billion people displaced by climate change. Now, the global governance systems, I mean, states will cease to exist. I had a look, the World Economic Forum just put out their risk assessment for the year. Their biggest circle, the size of the circle is the size of the risk. Their biggest circle in their risk assessment was state breakdown. So in their own way, they know it too. So I think there's going to be a huge political disjuncture in order to get us into a different mode of operating, or we will head to what Will Stephens said, hothouse earth. That's the choice.
Yeah, I think that it was really extremely helpful that you highlighted, especially those, how likely it is and how do we deal, I mean, what you call risk management. Obviously, we are far away from where we need to go. We know, and I think you explicitly appreciated what the climate movement is doing on the one hand, that there is I see really an increasing protest against what the governments are, or the lack of activities. We see, and that's the other positive side, we see a growing kind of interest in some of the technical solutions that are around, which also I find important, also offer the opportunity of changing the society, make it just, we had last week or the last time we had a friend from Africa, from Mali, who spoke about how new technologies can help a country like Mali, not only to get access to modern energy, but also to become more resilient against climate change. So I think these are, obviously, there's rays of hope. You're guiding us into the direction, how to better manage that. I appreciate very much. And thank you. And Janine, for the final remarks to you.
Oh, thank you very much, Stefan. And thank you, David. I really appreciate your blunt honesty about how dangerous it is, because not many people are willing to say these things. And we need it on record. We need people to listen more than once to these words.
Thank you.
And I thank you also for your comments about civil disobedience. I see Last Generation. I see Restore Wetlands, also called Återställa Våtmarker in Sweden. I see Blockade Australia. I see Stop Fossil Fuel Subsidies, Just Stop Oil. The latest one was New Zealand has, I think, reinstall passenger trains, climate emergency in the US. All these groups are really willing to stand up. Scientist Absolutely. Rebellion is now joining them, along with Make Them Pay. And actions will get far more serious during 2023. Unfortunately, states are also getting quite draconian in their ways to handle these activists. So I hope people like yourself will continue to back them and continue to push forward these methods, because that's the way we created democracy. That's the way we created, that's what the suffragettes did. That's what gay rights did. And that's what the civil rights movement was about. So that's the path it's maybe not the only path. Technology is also important, but it's definitely a path we need to take.
Thank you both for the conversation, the opportunity. It's I won't say it's been fun, but it's been very engaging.
Thank you so much. Thank you to our audience. And we will soon come back to you with the next episode. And the question of climate justice will certainly be a very important one. Climate justice for the whole world. Thank you and goodbye.